as a narrative of the person you interview. Maybe I should give you a little my name, where I'm from originally, and how I got here.
To a good background.
Life. Yeah. Okay. I left Virginia in 1949, came to Kodiak. I left Seattle in end of August of 49 on the steamship Denali. It was an Alaska steamship boat. It was one of the last trips to Kodiak. At that time, they made about one trip a month. It carried passengers and freight. And for $90, I came up steerage, and there were 9 or 11 of us in steerage. Steerage was at the stern of the ship, right by the engine room.
Super economy type.
Yeah, and yeah. The galley was right above. So all the good fumes came down into the steerage area, and it was all a bunk area, about 4 or 5 bunks high. And what it was used for was in the spring and fall. In the spring, it'd bring up the cannery workers, and in the fall, take them back. So I was right in between. And John Martin of Kodiak was a guide and a bush pilot up here at the time. So I kept him cornered all the time on bear stories and hunting stories, and he's still in town. And I think he's in poor health now. And
Morton?
Bell's Dairy, older boy, was one of the group. Remember him well because he was one of the few of us that didn't get seasick. And he says the reason he didn't, because he always had a beer in his hand.
Maybe I should have tried that.
But anyway, to save money, I came up that way, and it took 11 days to get here, and it got so boring that by the time we got to Seward. By the time we got to Seward, we were just looking for something to do, and they were short of people to load salmon aboard, the cases of salmon, so they came down and recruited most of us. And we worked all night in Seward, and we worked 2 hours and have coffee and donuts. Every 4 hours we fed. We were fed a big meal. And then when we finished up at Seward, the ship went around to Homer. We had to rest between Seward and Homer, which was a short rest. We worked over there for about 8 or 9 hours. Then the ship turned around and went back to Seward, and we worked back there 8 or 9 more hours, and then it came to Kodiak. So,
well, did you get wages?
Working? Yeah, we got wages.
Working?
Overtime wages, too.
Overtime?
After the first 8 hours.
Wow.
And so I much more than paid my passage up by that little workout. But anyway, I arrived in Kodiak, I think, about the 11th of September. And my brother worked on base. He came up during the war in January 1945. And he's the one that got me up here. And shortly after I arrived, I went to work in the pipe shop on the base as a plumber's helper. And Kodiak was really different then. The old highway to town was up above the existing slide, little narrow road, you know, down by Sealand Dock there,
right,
where that slide is now.
Yeah.
The highway was up there about the top where the slide began.
Well, that's the road, like, if you start out on Pillar, you can take from Pillar all the way out to Bell's Flats almost without ever the main road?
Well, this is in the front.
Oh, on the front
side? Bay side.
Okay.
It, let's see. You know where the gravel pit is, at a rock pit is, Brecken has, right above Gibson Cove? Right in there, instead of dropping down the sea line dock, you stayed that level and went on into town.
Okay.
And you dropped down just before you got to that big apartment building up on a hill just as you go into town.
Cope up on Street or whatever it is?
Before you get there.
Okay.
Before you get into the final turn that takes you right on into town. Has a sixplex up on top of the hill up there.
Yeah.
Somewhere in that area is where the road dropped on into town.
Thanks, Carol.
And they had some of the slides in that area, big rock slides over the years. That's why they went to the road down below.
Forced them to move it down.
Yeah. And we were used to the old coming to work in LCM at times. People lived in town on kind of rock slides. But after I went to work on the base, I lived in civilian barracks C-13. And there was one, two, three civilian barracks existing that time. The fourth had burned down, and it was absolutely packed with civilians, two to a room, H-shaped buildings, and I don't know how many people it held, but there were...
Were those the ones up by where, like, the new garage is, N1 is now,
mm-hmm.
up in that
mm-hmm.
stretch of
yeah.
the... Okay, right along
yeah.
Basetown Road.
Right there. The parking lot behind C1, there was two there, and where the garage set was another one.
Okay.
And then the contractor mess hall and the civilian club, or the contractors club at that time, was right across the street where the... Well, you know where the old SIP club was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, that old SIP club was more than double the size when I got here than it was when you saw it.
Okay.
They covered that whole block there.
Wow.
The mess hall itself was about the size of the galley, including the King's Inn and the whole that whole building there. It used to be mess hall, Navy mess hall, and.
Yeah, I can remember reading on the prints that the King's Inn used to be the bakery,
mm-hmm.
the old Navy bakery
yeah.
area.
Yeah, they had the bakery and the butcher shop and the whole works over there at that time.
Okay.
And and let's see. Well, there were Government Hill was known as Civilian Hill. You know, all the duplexes were occupied by civilians. They were built for civilians, contractors.
Mm-hmm.
And Aviation Hill was the fourplexes up there had been converted from barracks buildings into fourplexes, and they were occupied mostly by military. And on the hill part overlooking the airstrip were Quonset huts, and they were occupied by civilians. And Bell Strat's Russian River area were there were some fourplexes there converted barracks, but mostly Quonsets. And about 90% of that area is occupied by civilians. There, I think at the time there were 700 or 800 civilian workers on base. And the only military was a few up on Aviation Hill and a few in Valley Flats. And that little section down there by the BOQ and the where the O Club used to be.
Okay, the old anchor.
Mm-hmm. And those four plexes right there on across the street from where the hospital is now, that area, and there,
right.
Between that and the old hospital. They were the only military houses on the base.
And that was their senior officers?
Mm-hmm. Senior officers.
You know, like 04 and above.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the ones right there by the, on the E Street were chiefs. I think it was 7 fourplexes there, the chiefs.
Okay.
And then they had the fourplex for the officers, senior officers, and then the 5 captain's quarters and admiral.
Command.
Admiral was here then too.
Yeah. Well, that was the, was it still called the 17th Naval District?
Mm-hmm.
Admiral was the one that was here?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Later on he was, I went to work out of Public Works Engineering over to COM 17 in 1967 as assistant district to the district civil engineer. And the admiral over there then was a commandant 17th Naval District / Commander Fleet Air Alaska / Commander Alaska Sea Frontier.
So he was basically, he wore 3 hats.
Yeah.
Busy camper.
Yeah, he was a rear admiral. But they closed it down in 71. And that's, I went back over and went to work back in Public Works Engineering again.
Wow, that was, what, about a year before the Coast Guard took it then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They shut that down.
And they shut the rest of the naval station down in 72.
Well, did they... Was the Coast Guard air station here then, before 71?
Not at, yeah, that was a Coast Guard air station here, but it was just a little detachment.
Okay. Yeah, that's...
And search and rescue. They had some Albatross aircraft, and I think they had a 123 or something like that, but twin engine, looks like a C-130.
Except it was just dual engine.
Yeah, dual engine, and,
yeah.
And I'm told by the pilots that one of the worst things, aircraft in the world, in the crosswind, landing in the crosswind. Well, Captain Beach, I don't know if you met him or not, he was...
Sandy Beach?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
He cracked one of them up.
I never knew that. Yeah, I was here... Well... He got relieved by Captain Schaefer in 81.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I was here for about a year and a half with him.
Yeah. He was a heck of a fine guy. I never did hear his story on it, but I think it was he got crosswind, gust of wind got him in landing or something.
Because Billadoo used to fly with him.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I remember Billadoo talking about that.
Yeah.
Back years ago, before he retired, that he had flown with Beach quite a bit.
Yeah. I bet he was a good pilot because he was brave enough.
Was it brave enough or crazy enough?
Yeah, a little of both, I think.
Yeah.
But anyway, when I got here in 49, I just couldn't believe it. That afternoon, the day I got here, my brother took me out to Anton Larson Bay, and the humpies and dogs and all that, they just had these tricks out there clogged with, you could almost walk across the backs of the salmon, and I just couldn't believe that was possible.
Yeah.
And all I could think about was hunting and fishing at that time.
Well, was that your biggest, I mean, before you come up, is that what enticed you to come up,
mm-hmm.
kind of, is the hunting and fishing aspect of it?
Yeah.
From what you'd heard and everything.
Yeah.
Yes. It still holds true then.
Yeah, it's well, there was game all over the place at that time. There was no deer season, so you'd see deer everywhere. And if you came out this way, well, first of all, there were hardly any vehicles here, private vehicles. Mm-hmm. And on a Friday night out there on the base, which was payday, there'd be, I think it was 17 or 18 cabs, and they'd all be lined up there by the Civ Club, waiting for people to run in and have their double shot. They always had double shot hour every night at quitting time for 2 hours or something like that. And then they'd cash checks on Friday evenings. And then the bachelors would go grab a cab and head for town.
Hasn't changed.
Like I say, there was hardly any vehicles here. Any private vehicles. I was real lucky. I've been here about 6 months, and a good friend of my brother's had a 1941 Dodge Command car for sale, and it was in real good shape. Had a canvas top on it, and I'll never forget. And he worked over at Army Diesel. The crew lived over there. The bachelor crew lived there. They ran that diesel 24 hours a day. I remember going over and paying him for it and getting a title. And I think it was in February, and it had been raining, but it was about 31 degrees out, it was slick and cold. And I got in, cranked it up, and started down that hill coming out of Army Diesel. And I hit a bump, and unbeknown to me, that canvas top was all sagged down with water.
Oh, no.
When I hit the bump, it split and dumped all that water right down my neck.
Then you had to turn around and put a new canvas top on.
Well, it didn't take long to get a plywood top built on it.
Oh, yes.
But anyway, at that time, that was the ideal vehicle for here. It was a better vehicle than the later model of the command car, which was a three-quarter ton weapons carrier. And the command car was all it was a weapons carrier with a passenger body on it that the officers used in the battlefield.
Yeah.
But you needed that to go out here in the summertime. There's no road maintenance at all, and the main gate was at the foot of Marine Hill on this side of the base, and it was out there. The other main gate was out there at that now where the road now just before we get Dead Man's Curve, right at the top of the hill where you.
Well, just past where Army Diesel is.
You turn off
Army Diesel and like where the S turns are before Dead Man's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the last turn is that you can take to the left to go to Army Diesel, going to town. The gate was about 50 yards further than that, where the road was pretty narrow there, and there was a big warehouse alongside of it, so they had it narrowed down where you couldn't get through it all around it, and it was manned by Marines. And you couldn't get on base unless you had a pass for no reason, or you had a permission ahead of time from the security office.
Command or something like that?
Yeah.
Okay.
And if you, the area this side of the base was more or less controlled by the military too. And Chaniac was owned and controlled by the military, but there was nothing there.
Well, was that Air Force or something?
No, the Air Force took it over.
Golly. I'd always thought that was where they had the strips. before it was Air Force, Army,
that was Army. Originally, it was the Army had it in World War II.
Okay.
Yeah, the Army had a base, had a defense out there, coastal defense.
Yeah.
And later on, the Navy put in a security group out there, at overlooking the on the other side of the lake, on the other side of the airfield.
Yeah.
The airstrip. That point out there was a Navy security group, and that was active in the 60s, I guess.
Wow. It stayed active up through the 60s?
Yeah, it was even active when they built the, I think it was, even active after they built the tracking station. The Air Force built a tracking station out there. But in the 50s, there wasn't anything out there except a bunch of Quonset huts and abandoned Quonset huts. And you'd come out hunting, and you'd maybe see on a Saturday or Sunday, you'd maybe see another vehicle all weekend. And you'd probably see Tom Felton, that has a ranch here in Middle Bay, which we bought the ranch from him in 1972. And then there was Tom Nelson out at Calson Bay, which was a rancher. Sid Olds was out in that area too. He had the ranch at some property in Calson Bay, and he had the ranch at Narrow Cape that the Burtons have now.
Burton Ranch, okay.
Yeah. But you could come out and in season, say the fall of the year, you can come out and get your limit of ducks, all the rabbits you want. I don't think there's any limit on them. And we were right in the, in near the peak of the cycle, and I think 48, 49 was the peak of the rabbit cycle. And it was so thick you could, sometimes you could walk into the trees and stand without stepping out of your footprints, shoot a half a dozen rabbits with a 22. Oh, they were so thick.
Dang.
Anyway, there was no problem at all coming out here and getting your limited ducks right here at Middle Bay, mallards and pintail and good game ducks. And then just take your time, go in the brush wherever you thought of a good spot and pick up all the rabbits you want. And fox all over the place and deer all over the place, which, like I said before, wasn't in season until I think the first season was about 52 on them. But anyway, we go on out to Narrow Cape, and if everybody hadn't loaded up on ducks, we'd hunt ducks for a while more, and then drive along the road at Narrow Cape past the Shad Shack, and a ptarmigan would flop beside the road. Big flocks of them.
Start getting them too.
And all you do is just watch them. They'd fly a couple hundred yards and sit down. And everybody got out of the car. You usually have four or five people with you because if you own the vehicle, you're a popular person.
I imagine.
And we'd go out and we'd approach the ptarmigan and they'd jump and we'd do our shooting. And we'd go and pick up our birds, and I think his limit was 20 apiece, something like that, and 40 in possession.
Wow.
And before you, the birds would fly another 100 yards and sit down again, and you pick up what you shot the first time and go over and jump them again. Maybe it could be 200 in a flock, too.
Wow.
And sometimes it'd be 7 or 8, and all the way on up to 300. And that's why there's probably not many ptarmigan today, because they're so dumb. You jump them, and they just fly and sit down and give you time to pick up the dead and reload and go after them again. And these are flatland ptarmigan. There wasn't any work to it.
Yeah.
I guess they were the willow ptarmigan. But anyway, you'd come back in after about a 14-hour hunt, and you had all the ptarmigan, ducks, and rabbits you could handle. and silver salmon that as I said, this was a fall, for example, and the rivers were just absolutely stuffed with silver salmon.
Did they have a limit on those too?
No.
On silvers?
No, and there wasn't any laws on how you could take them either. You could snag them, you could spear them, you could gaff them.
Reach over, pick them up?
Just about. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And so you really load up, and as I said, fox were all over the place, but that time of year, the hides weren't any good. And also, you might tow the boat out and launch it at, we always launched at Brookins Lagoon on the other side of Calson Bay there, in the spring of the year, this was. And seal hunt, as they were, there's a bounty on seal, you just scalp them, send the seal, the scalps to Juneau.
Why'd they have is there a reason for having a bounty on it?
Competing against fishermen for salmon.
Oh, okay.
And they were thick here in those days. That rookery out there at Brookins Lagoon must have had a couple hundred in it, and that was one of the small rookers.
Wow.
And they were almost tame. It was the first time I went out there seal hunting. I'd never even been close to a seal in my life. And we just drove right up into the reef right where they were, and if we'd had a bannet, we could have loaded the boat, but we didn't know what to shoot because they had all the heads were all around the boat. So we didn't get any out on the initial thing. The way we did it was two or three people get off and lay on the reef, and then one guy would take the skiff, which was probably about a 13-foot skiff with 10 horsepower kicker on it. He'd go down and get behind another reef out of the way, and all his heads would be popping up all over the place. The seal would start coming back in to see what was going on, and so you just popped them. Then the boat would run around and pick them up, and they'd bring them ashore and scalp them, and that's all we'd take.
Was the scalp, and then just leave the carcass and everything?
We'd take the liver. Of the young ones. That liver was excellent to eat. And then, besides the other things they had out here in the way of hunting, chances are you could run into a bear. And at that time, they were paying $2 a piece for eagle bounty. And I'd say it was in the early 50s. And the eagles were thick. We used to pick up a lot of money with guys would buy 220 Swift rifles for them.
Just go out and get spending money with the bounty on the eagles and the seals and stuff.
Yeah, bought all the ammunition for the rest of the hunting.
I'll be darned.
Now you don't dare get caught with a feather.
Yep.
Now, me and the eagles and I always called them a glorified buzzard, especially when we had the ranch here, and occasionally they would get a calf, especially if the cow was down or something. If a cow happened to get pregnant at the wrong time and had a calf in the early spring or something like that, when there was ice and stuff still on the ground, and maybe she would get down with the calf and then couldn't get up again. We had several that the eagles got that way, and they were protected then, so we couldn't do any shooting.
Yeah. When did they, do you recall when they became protected, the eagles?
I think it's about, I'm not sure, about 54 somewhere now, I think.
Mid-50s.
Yeah, early 50s, I think it was. I know I must have had 10 pair of feet that I didn't bother to send in, and then so it was a change, so I never did get paid for them, but I just kept them anyway. Then pretty soon it got to the point where it was illegal to even have them, so I had to destroy them.
Yeah,
threw them in the garbage. Another thing in the 50s, there wasn't too much alder here.
I thought that stuff grew wild everywhere up here.
Yeah, it was quite a bit on the hillsides, but nothing, not even close to what it is now. You could drive from town to Chaniac, and you could see the water, you know, about 90% of the way, unless a hill or something was obstructing you.
Mm-hmm.
There was no brush obstructing your view of the ocean at all.
Oh, yeah.
You may have had some willows or salmonberry bushes and stuff mm-hmm. like that, but nothing any higher than that. And the old military roads, they were the first to start growing when the abandoned ones were start growing the alder. Seemed like every time you disturbed the soil, it would turn into an alder patch after that. And they particularly like areas that would have been graveled over, like a old roadbed. They just loved to take over those. But the grass wouldn't take over before the alder did, so the alder get a head start on the grass. Out there behind Comstay, the transmitter area,
yeah,
there's old roads all over that. They were the first to go. That I noticed it got so bad that in later years, in '70s, if you hunted in that area, you couldn't follow the old roadbed at all. You couldn't get through the alder. You had to go to either side of it.
The alder's right up through the road now.
Yeah,
it's weird. It wouldn't hurt me a bit if they just burned every one of the alder bushes out of this. This island.
I wish the Japanese would find some use for that.
Exactly.
We could retire the national debt.
Just off of Kodiak's alders.
Yeah. And wasn't as many spruce trees by a long way either as there is now.
So they picked up pretty good too then.
Yeah. I don't know what caused it, but it's particularly the alder.
Was the climate about the same then, as far as weather?
In the 50s, it was worse. Worse than it is now, by a long shot.
More typical Alaskan weather.
I think
weather
it was the winter of 50-51. We had roofs blow off some of the housing on Aviation Hill. We had these old military barracks buildings converted to fourplexes. And same thing down on the Nauman's Peninsula. I remember one right near the existing cargo dock.
Mm-hmm.
It blew, I don't know how it managed to do it, but it blew the house apart. The ends and the front were in one piece. And the whole back wall, for the full length of that house, probably 120 foot long, you could go back there and grab it and shake it. It completely separated from the rest of the building. And it was a tall bank behind it, mm-hmm. a rock bank, so it couldn't fall over. And that wall just opened up.
Whoa.
And it was occupied by four families.
And that was down by where they had the old auto hobby?
Yeah, before you get to that. Just
okay, where they've got that area cut out in the rock then.
Mm-hmm. It was
there.
Yeah, uh-huh. The print shop and this house used to be right in that area, right in the area by the cargo dock. The cargo dock now. At that mm-hmm. time, the cargo dock was over there where Brecken's got his dock, the lash dock. Across the bay,
yeah,
on the west side of Owens Bay.
Well, during the war, that's where they had, if I remember right from the print room, when I was there in the early 80s working up there, the ones where the lash dock is, wasn't that what they called where they tied up the destroyers and stuff like that that would come in?
No, that was the main cargo dock.
Oh, it was?
Mm-hmm. That's where they had a transit shed there that was about the size of... the transit shed down there at the city dock number 2, which is the old city dock.
The old city.
Not the sea line dock, the other one. Okay. Probably bigger. It was all wood frame building. And all the cargo came in there. Mm-hmm. Of course, that was all, the entire base was that
area. Yeah, that was still part of the base proper mm-hmm. type thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Marginal Pier is where they tied up the destroyers and the old Marginal Pier.
Okay.
And they had
what's
a
left of it.
They had a floating dry dock. When I got here, I think ARD 22 was there, and it was handled some fairly large boats. I don't think it would handle a destroyer.
See, it was who was it? Joe Donahue, I think, was the one telling me that. Where the old Marginal Pier is now, that used to be the, they kind of classified all of Nyman's Pen mm-hmm. as the sub base area, and that's where the subs used to tie up.
Yeah.
And they'd come in for supplies and stuff.
Yeah, during the war.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. After the, when I got here, it was a repair area. Doggone it, the name just left my tongue. Ship repair facility.
Okay.
And they had many, many civilians working down there. There were three shops on the dock. The old hobby shop that burnt down, mm-hmm. that was a huge shop building. S-37, right next door to it was a big shop building, and they could overhaul propeller shafts, and they could do all sorts of work, and they were in support of the floating dry dock there.
Okay.
And they handled the repairs on smaller, you know, they take in a big tug and and those kind of boats.
Just basically rebuild it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They could just about do everything. Yeah, ship repair facility is what it was. SRU, ship repair unit, I guess it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had the old torpedo shops and stuff still down there, but they've been converted to ship repair usage.
After the war.
Yeah, after the war.
Yeah.
In fact, the old the building that Special Services has now with the boats in it, that was a torpedo shop, repair shop.
Okay.
And that's one of the few still left that were here in Benoit.
Now see, I had heard years ago when I was here in the early 80s that's what that was a torpedo shop.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, because I couldn't figure out, well, why in a hobby shop would they have the overhead crane track and everything?
Yeah.
And that's what people used to tell me is it was the torpedo repair.
Yeah.
And everything.
And building 25 was an aircraft storehouse. That's right next to the old supply building.
Yeah.
And then the next building over north of that was a supply building. And then the cold storage was the next one over. I got
37.
Yeah.
Things have changed a little then.
Yeah. C-1, all the C buildings were contractor buildings.
Yeah.
And they more or less stayed on the west side of the base. And all their buildings, they had dozens and dozens of big buildings.
So they used. Well, that was made it simpler then, didn't it, for recognizing what was military and what was contractors just by the numbering of them?
Mm-hmm.
If you knew it had a C, then you knew that was a contractor.
Right. And S stood for sub-base area. A stood for Army.
Okay.
And at one time, there were a bunch of buildings, particularly in Bell's Flats area, Russian Creek. Were numbered with NOB numbers for the Naval Operating Base.
Oh, okay.
The Navy couldn't make up their mind what it was. Kodiak was going to be, so they, one time it'd be a naval operating base, next time it'd be an air station, next time it'd be a naval station, and then you'd go do it all over again.
Typical military operation.
Yeah.
Well, you'd mentioned about bear hunting.
Yeah.
When you're first.
Oh, yeah. I guess it was the spring of 50, in May of 50, first part of May of 50. My brother and I and two other friends that had been here before me quite a while decided to go bear hunting. So we chartered a fishing boat from Pete Walkoff of Yuzinki, and his brother Paul lived in town, and he set it up for us with his brother in Yuzinki. And came time to, we were going to go to Yuak Bay to bear hunt, and we had use of a little cabin there. I think it belonged to some guide that my brother knew that we could use for the 2 weeks we planned for the hunt. But, so anyway, came time to load up and leave, and a storm had been blowing for about 2 days and northeaster, and so we were delayed a day, I believe. Finally, Pete said we'd give it a try, so we loaded up his boat and headed out, and his wife and I think two or three children, I've forgotten how many it was, two or three. We're going to ride back to Kodiak to use. He was going to drop him off at their home in Yuzinki as we went through the Yuzinki area. And we got up to Spruce Cape, and waves out there about 30 foot high, swells, and they were fairly close together too. And that old boat was really going bad. So they always went through the rocks. Those fishermen always went through the rocks, and
no, thank you.
That's the rocks between that little island with the light on it out there.
Yeah,
right off of Spruce Cape, and you go between there and Spruce Cape. That's the shortcut to Yuzinki, and we got about it in the middle of it, and his engine quit. There we were going. The waves are pounding us toward shore fast. So he started, we got down and they discovered it was water in the gas, and it shaking up at the way the storm had, the water had shook up the tank real good, and he was getting water out of his gas tank. And it was about a 40 foot fishing boat, I think, thereabouts, and we were getting pretty scared by that time. And finally got the line put back together, and some of the water drained out, cranked her up, and we pulled back out to where we'd started to get back in the channel through the rocks. And just soon we got making headway toward Yuzinki, it quit again. And that happened three times going through those rocks before they started running smooth.
Got all the water out of them.
Yeah. And what tickled me is I've never been on a boat that size, and a fishing boat, and I almost got sick on the Denali, and I figured sure I was going to get sick there, and I figured all the rest of us would too, the four of us, And we did fine. But here, Pete Walkoff's family, his wife and kids, got seasick. And they were born here.
They grew up.
They've been on a fishing boat. I mean, their transportation was a fishing boat.
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe it. But anyway, we finally got out of the rocks, and by the time they got to Yuzinka, we were in calm water again. And we dropped them off at Yuzinka, and then we went on through Whale Pass, Shilikoff Straits, and we got started in the Yuak Bay. It must have been about 11 o'clock in the evening, and it was getting pitch black. It was kind of pretty cloudy, too.
Yeah.
So Pete decided we'd pull up to some old cannery there on the right-hand side of Yuak Bay going in. We pulled into there in the old rickety cannery, and we slept overnight there. And then at daybreak, we went on into Aylock Island, and on the, I guess you'd call it, southeast end of Aylock Island was that cabin. And we unloaded our gear on the beach, and we had a couple hundred feet to haul it up to the cabin. So we looked the place up, went up to the cabin, looked it over, and cleaned it out and everything. And then came back and started packing the stuff up to the cabin. And we hadn't even got everything off. We were watching Pete go on down Yuak Bay. He was going to go down and go around the southeast end of Aymuck Island and go on over to Larson Bay and visit over there before he went home. And he got down there. He hadn't even got to the end of Aymuck Island. And we were hauling the gear up. We look here, see the boat coming back. We couldn't understand. We must have left something on the boat or something. So